Thanks for listening.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section. When Dad injured his back. When your basketball star tore his ACL. Opioids helped with the pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Opioids are powerful pain-reducing prescription medicines, but most people who are prescribed opioids don't finish their prescriptions. So millions of unused opioids are sitting in homes across the country, and tragically, more than 100 Americans die every day from overdoses involving opioids. What can you do to protect your family? Remove the risk of unused opioids from your home. Pills, patches, or syrups in drawers, purses, and cabinets. Anywhere they might be hiding. To find out how to dispose of them properly, visit www.fda.gov/drug disposal.
The future depends on teachers. Every day, teachers are shaping our tomorrows, starting their students on journeys that will change the course of history. Right now, in a classroom somewhere in the United States, there's a teacher inspiring a future scientist who will make preventing pandemics their life's work, sharpening the mind of an aspiring environmentalist who will help combat climate change, and generating possibilities for a student who will be the first in their family to graduate college. It all starts with teachers who meet challenges with creativity, who reinvent education for the future, who work towards a school system that lifts up every child, regardless of race, income, or zip code, and who enable the full potential of our students, our communities, and our country. Explore a career that leaves a legacy you can be proud of. Shape the future. Teach. Learn more and receive free support at teach.org.
My opinion, Israel controls Middle East policy in the United States. Trump is in the pocket of Netanyahu, it seems. Without U.S. military support, Israel would not have been able to maintain their slaughter of Gaza for more than a few months. The United States enables Israel to ignore international law and to reject every single peace agreement. This is not an exaggeration.
That's Richard Forer. And this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Richard Forer on Israel, the U.S., and Palestine. Noam Chomsky calls the Israel, U.S., and Palestine relationship a fateful triangle. He says, in no other region of the world are the problems so likely to lead to devastating regional conflict. He adds, those problems have only been aggravated by the irrationality and intolerance that has dominated discussion in the United States. It will be unfortunate, Chomsky warns, if this state of affairs persists. Chomsky wrote those words more than 50 years ago. The U.S. has given Israel hundreds of billions of dollars in aid over the years. In addition, Washington provides crucial diplomatic, political, and military support. Internationally, because of Gaza, both the U.S. and Israel are increasingly isolated. Moshe Yalon, former Israeli chief of staff and defense minister, says Israel is committing war crimes and ethnic cleansing. Our guest today is Richard Forer. He spent time in the West Bank and Gaza. He has Orthodox Jewish relatives living in West Bank settlements. He's a former member of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. He's the author of Wake Up, Essays on the Tragedy of Israel-Palestine, winner of the New York Big Book Award. I talked with Richard Forer at the Boulder Public Library in late March. I want to welcome Richard Forer to the program. Good
Thank
to
you,
see
David.
You again,
Same
Richard.
Here.
Anti-Semitism, what is it?
Well, traditionally, anti-Semitism was hatred of Jews because they were Jews. And now it's become Well, to quote Jonathan Greenblatt, the head of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, which calls itself the largest Jewish civil rights organization in the world, Greenblatt specifically said anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. But really what he means is you're an anti-Semite if you are anti-Jewish supremacy. They're taking criticism of Israel to be anti-Semitic because Israel is a Jewish supremacist state, and it does not confer equal rights to all of its citizens, only to Jews. When I was growing up, and this applies to pretty much all Jews of my generation, and probably certainly generations before me, and probably generations after me, I thought Zionism was a movement to protect Jews from further persecution. So from that point of view, and not having studied the history, because most people haven't studied the history, I never did until 2006. I was ignorant. I thought Israel was an innocent country just trying to make peace with its Arab neighbors who were anti-Semitic. But from the point of view of someone who believes that Israel was a necessary haven from the perils of anti-Semitism, from thousands of years of persecution, I can understand why a Jewish person would react to criticism of Israel. However, the last 20 years or so, especially since Netanyahu has been prime minister, have shown just how cruel, insensitive, inhumane, and bigoted Israel is. So when people call us, anyone who criticizes Israel, we're basically ipso facto anti-Semites. What they're really doing is denying their own bigotry and projecting it onto us. I have a principle that I talk about in my book, which one of the universal principles I cite is that the real enemy is not someone or something outside of us. The real enemy is the unexamined mind that unconsciously projects its suffering onto the other and then blames and scapegoats the other for its suffering. And so what people are doing when they call us anti-Semites, it's a reflex. They've never studied the history. They don't know us. They don't know what motivates us to criticize Israel, really, because they're too blind to our humanity. But what they are doing is, it's a reflex, so they don't have to consider the fact that their support for Israel is inhumane, that what they are doing is exactly what they are saying that we are doing and exactly what they would say the Nazis did. Okay, so they are trying to protect themselves from their own conscience and from their own inhumanity. For example, if Defense for Children International, and they're not the only organization, but they focus on children, when they speak about the suffering of children, the abuse of children by the Israeli military and by settlers, they're called anti-Semitic. We are called anti-Semites if we care about children. And so, for example, in my book, I talk about how Human Rights Watch said that Israel's treatment of children would terrify and traumatize any adult. So if I were to say that to a supporter of Israel, they would call me an anti-Semite. They would accuse me of belittling and slandering Israel. Anti-Semitism is not whether or not people who criticize Israel are anti-Semites. The real issue is what is going on in the minds of the accusers. They are the bigots who are projecting their bigotry onto us and calling us what is true of them.
So people like Norman Finkelstein, Noam Chomsky, Amy Goodman, Medea Benjamin, yourself, are then put in a different category because you can't be anti-Semitic. You happen to be Jewish, so you're a self-hating Jew.
That, yes, although actually Jonathan Greenblatt, again, he referred to the JVP demonstrators in New York City, most of whom were Jewish, demonstrating against the genocide. He referred to them as anti-Semites. In other words, even if you're a Jew, you're an anti-Semite if you don't simply support what Israel is doing, if you don't remain blind and ignorant as Jonathan Greenblatt is. So that's why he's obviously an educated person, and yet he doesn't know anything about the history. And you know why he doesn't know anything about the history? Because he doesn't want to know anything about the history, because anything he would find out about the history would reflect upon his self-imagery. And it's self-imagery that is the heart of all of this suffering. That's the reason why, for example, I don't want to talk too much about him, but my identical twin brother cannot hear anything. To him, every Arab wants to kill every Jew. So he has a self-image of himself, as do most Jews, as being fair and humane people. I always thought I was fair and humane. I didn't think that I was a bigot. I didn't think that my criticism of Palestinians was because I was insensitive or prejudiced. I just thought they were psychopaths, okay? But they weren't. And speaking of that, Benny Morris, the famous Israeli historian, calls Palestinians serial killers and psychopaths. That's why, for him, his self-image does not require that he see all people as equal. His self-image includes the fact that Jews are superior. Most American Jews, certainly myself and my friends growing up, we never really saw ourselves as superior. Maybe we saw ourselves as a bit more moral than the Goyim who had tried to destroy the Jewish people. But we didn't think that we were prejudiced against Palestinians or Arabs. We just thought they were anti-Semites who wanted to destroy the state of Israel and world Jewry, just like the Nazis had done. So it boils down to self-imagery. If you have a self-image of yourself as fair and humane, you're going to project and you support Israel. You're going to see Israel the way you see yourself. But what you are really not seeing is the real Israel. You are seeing a projection of Israel, of your idealistic images. That's what you're seeing. These people don't see Israel. They don't care about Israel. They see their self-imagery and they see and they care about their own ego identity. They care about protecting and preserving this illusion that they have of who they are. And it's an illusion because they're not fair and humane. That is a belief system, as is the way they identify themselves. And the crux of the matter is, will people wake up and look in the mirror, or are they going to simply defend their own self-imagery, even in the face of thousands and thousands of children being killed, slaughtered, and other people dying?
Of Donald Trump, you write in your book that he has a history of Islamophobic and anti-Semitic pronouncements. Can you give some examples?
Yeah.
And what does that say about the political culture of the United States in 2025?
Yeah. Well, just 2 weeks ago, he called Chuck Schumer one of Israel's strongest supporters. He said that Chuck Schumer had become a Palestinian. But throughout his career, there was the Muslim ban. He'd wanted to prevent all Muslims coming into the country. He was trashing Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib when he was president. He called for a database of every American Muslim, or I should say every Muslim living in the United States, and he wanted to surveil every mosque in the United States. And this is really probably just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, Trump believes what he's told by Miriam Adelson and Netanyahu and the prevailing beliefs of the neocons. He just believes it. Since he doesn't read anything, and since he doesn't contemplate anything, he just believes it. And of course, by believing it, he reaps monetary benefit, like he has from the Adelsons, for example.
Explain who Miriam Adelson is.
Okay, Miriam Adelson is the widow of Sheldon Adelson, who was a billionaire, casino owner, Las Vegas, Macau. And in 2016, the Adelsons gave $27 million directly to Trump's campaign and at least double that to the Republican National Committee on the condition that if Donald Trump were elected president, he moved the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which he did. And then Miriam Adelson, in the latest election against Kamala, Miriam Adelson put in over $100 million into a super PAC, and her condition was that Donald Trump, if elected president, recognize and allow the Israel's annexation of the West Bank. Okay, which, by the way, Itamar Ben-Gavir, who's going to rejoin the Netanyahu coalition, since Netanyahu has violated phase two of the ceasefire, Itamar Ben-Gavir just introduced a bill in the Knesset to void the Oslo Accords, the Y River Memorandum, and the Hebron Protocols, which gave some land to the Palestinians. So he wants to eliminate the legal basis for the Palestinians being on some of this land as a prelude to annexation. And exactly 1 year ago, Bezalel Smotrich, who's in the coalition, the Minister of Finance, who was also in charge of the occupation of the West Bank, 1 year ago, they seized, the State of Israel seized, I think it was 3.8 square miles of Palestinian land in the West Bank, the largest seizure of land since the Oslo Accords. And of course, the Oslo Accords, the land giveaway was Area C, for the most part, which is 61% of the West Bank and is under Israeli administrative and military control. What we're seeing now is not just the inevitable, predictable violation of the ceasefire, and Tamir Pardo, Israel's former Mossad chief, just said that Netanyahu, the reason that Netanyahu violated the ceasefire because he doesn't care about the Israeli people, he only cares about retaining his position as prime minister.
So he doesn't have to go in position would be threatened because he's charged with criminal activities.
Well, he's charged with criminal activities, but also killing people in Gaza and attacking Gaza. It's much harder for the Knesset to call for elections. He also knows that by doing it, he's keeping Bezalel Smotrich in the coalition. So when Netanyahu signed the ceasefire under Trump's orders in January, and Trump told him he could do whatever he wanted after phase one, but when Netanyahu agreed to the ceasefire, Itamar Ben-Gvir left the coalition and took his Knesset votes with him. But Gideon Saar entered the coalition, so Netanyahu still had a majority in the Knesset. Bezalel Smotrich, though, told Netanyahu, I will stay in the coalition under these conditions. And the conditions were, which Netanyahu loved, you cannot proceed beyond phase one. You cannot continue to phase two. You have to attack. Number two, you have to give me greater authority to expand settlements in the West Bank and to ethnically cleanse Palestinians. And this is exactly what they're doing. A week or two ago, Israel, maybe it was 3 weeks ago, in Jenin mostly, Israel expelled over 40,000 Palestinians and said, you're never going to come back. I don't know where they went. And then they've invaded other Tokaram, and they invaded areas of Nablus. And this is just a process. This is the inevitable conclusion of the Zionist project, which was always based on the world is anti-Semitic, and the only way we Jews can live in peace is to get rid of the Goyim. So this is the inevitable conclusion. They want to expel the Palestinians. And the amazing thing is that their greatest supporters are anti-Semites, the Christian evangelicals, who believe that Jews have to go to hell unless they become Christians when Jesus returns. And Theodor Herzl predicted this. Theodor Herzl said that the anti-Semites will become our best friends. And that was pretty much true from the beginning, because Herzl called religious Jews kikes, which is about the worst word you can use for a Jew. He said they were disgusting, unspeakable. If you read Theodor Herzl's comments about religious Jews, if you didn't know it was Herzl, you would think it was Adolf Hitler. But what Herzl understood was that the religious Jews detested Zionism, because to the religious Jews, only God, through the Moshiach from the house of King David, only the Moshiach can create a Jewish state. A Jewish state cannot be created by man. Zionism is blood and soil, just like the Nazis. Zionism is a nationalistic movement to create a Jewish state without regard to the Torah. So Herzl was an atheist. He didn't circumcise his son. He told the Pope, he literally told the Pope, that if the Pope would help him find a piece of land for the Jewish people, he would have them converted to Roman Catholicism. So my point is that the Zionist movement from the very beginning was supported by the Christian Zionists. Christian Zionism preceded Jewish Zionism, because the Christian Zionists wanted the Jews to leave. They wanted them out of Europe. So that's why Theodor Herzl was saying that the anti-Semites would be the Jews' best friends. And so this is really what has happened. During World War II, Yitzhak Shamir, who was the head of the Stern Gang and became prime minister after Menachem Begin, who was the head of the Irgun, Jewish terrorist gangs, Shamir's people went to the Nazis and said, look, you believe in the Aryan race, that they're superior. We believe Jews are superior. You want to get rid of the Jews? Fine. Send them to us. Send them to Palestine. So there was always this kind of connection in a perverse way between Zionism and Nazism. And as the U.S. State Department said in 1944, they are very similar. They are both based on blood and soil.
Blutenboden, I think, is the German. Now, Gábor Máté is a very interesting figure. He's a Hungarian-born Jew. He's a physicist, author. He's based in Vancouver, British Columbia. And in a recent alternative radio program, he talked about how can Jews of all people support and rationalize genocide. And then you respond, what people really want to know is why? Why do my relatives who all always have supported civil rights, why do they support Israel? Why do rabbis who talk about Jewish values and tikkun olam, you can translate that, that's Hebrew, why do they support Netanyahu and Jewish supremacy? Why?
Tikkun olam is healing the world. There's another term in Judaism called dira betachtonim, which is to make a dwelling place for the divine. So from the point of view of certain Hasidic Jewish sects, the reason the Jews are chosen is to make the world a dwelling place for the divine. But these sects are among the most virulently anti-Palestinian. So they are obviously misunderstanding the wisdom of their own teachings, because they are taking their teachings and making their teachings conform to their ego rather than surrendering their ego to the wisdom of the teachings. But in answer to that question, it's all about self-imagery. From the very beginning, Israel accused the Arabs, Nasser in particular, Gamal Abdel Nasser, the head of Egypt. From the very beginning, they accused the Arabs of wanting to finish what the Nazis had started. And even today, you will constantly hear Knesset members, rabbis, refer to Arabs or Palestinians as Nazis. And so they have this image as Nazis. So that's why my answer to Gábor Máté, the reason people support all these horrors is because they think they're just defending themselves from Nazis. And it's the same reason they don't believe. For the most part, they either don't believe that Israel is literally deliberately killing children and unarmed civilians. They think that's another slur. But even those who believe it, well, then they'll rationalize it. I've heard people, and it's more Israeli Jews than American Jews, because Israeli Jews are really brought up from birth to see the Palestinians as a mortal threat to them. Okay, but I have seen articulate Israelis on YouTube say things like, if I could push a button right now and kill every single Palestinian, I would do it. And I think most Jews in Israel would do it too. I've heard people say that stuff. And there are, Al Jazeera has compiled a list of at least 2,500 videos from Jewish soldiers bragging about killing children and killing civilians. That little girl, there's a human rights organization in Belgium named after her, and they submitted a brief to the International Court of Justice with 1,000 names and videos of Israeli soldiers bragging about murdering children and other civilians as part of the case against Israel, against Netanyahu and Gallant, and there should be others, for genocide. But again, it all boils down to self-imagery. We see the world through the prism of our ego, or of our ego identity, our self-imagery. This is why it's impossible for so many Jews to believe that even Netanyahu, that even their leaders could possibly do to the Palestinians or to anyone what has been done to them. They just cannot see it because it's not even a part of their frame of reference. It's almost like the Native Americans when the ships first came to the New World in the 1400s. They didn't see them because they had no concept. And they were out in the ocean and they could not see that there were ships there. They saw the men when they approached and entered the shore, but they couldn't see the ships. It's very similar to that.
Discuss, too, the paradox of victims becoming persecutors.
One of the things that was really central to Israel's establishment was power. Israel always knew, or at least thought they knew, that they had to have immense power so that nobody could ever screw the Jews again like the Nazis had and like the Russian Cossacks had with all the pogroms for the years and all the other enemies of the Jews throughout history, many of whom, it's fictitious. A lot of the history has been debunked. But yes, the Cossacks, in particular the Ukrainians and the Nazis, of course, were extremely cruel to Jews. So in their trauma and the need to create a Jewish state, they determined that they had to have immense power so no one could screw with them again. But what is really amazing is the vast majority of Jews didn't want a Jewish state. Okay, it was only because the Zionist organizations prevented Western Europe and the United States from taking in Jews after the Holocaust that Israel was able to become a state, because the Jews had nowhere to go. They were forced to go to Palestine. In 1947, 55,000 Jews European Jews applied to immigrate to the United States. And the vast, vast majority of them said that if they couldn't go to the United States, they'd go anywhere but Israel, but Palestine. Okay, so there was this great... So it was a con job by the Zionist movement. They conned the world into establishing Israel, and they conned the Jewish people, or forced the Jewish people, a lot of the Jewish people to go there so there would be a large enough population that the UN would vote for a partition Jewish state, which was the prelude to the establishment in 1948 of the State of Israel.
Angela Davis once told me, victimization cannot be permitted to function as a halo of innocence. Is that operative in this instance?
What I should say, if you have the self-image of yourself as a victim, you will draw events to yourself, or you will interpret events in a way that confirms to yourself that you really are a victim. In the case of Israelis, they're victims, they're perpetrators, and all of this has to do with the stories they've told themselves about Jewish persecution, in particular, the Holocaust. Gabor Mate talks about trauma a lot, and I agree with him, but a lot of the trauma is self-traumatization. Israelis are traumatizing themselves with the stories they tell themselves. Okay, you know, when you grow up as a kid and you're taught by your school teachers, probably your parents, and certainly the government, that the world hates Jews, that you have to protect yourselves against the Palestinians because they're serial killers and psychopaths. That's why you need a wall. That's why you need to confine them. That's why you need to keep ethnically cleansing them to get rid of them. When you're taught all that from the time you're a little child, it becomes self-evident to you. That's how you're going to see the Palestinians. Not only that, it's not even something that you could even question. It's kind of like a lot of people automatically take for granted that there's a God and that you're going to go to heaven. And it's something they don't even question. It's certainly something they've never inquired into, you know, within themselves. They just believe it because they were taught it as children, and they cannot conceive that anything other than that could be true.
The younger generation, at least in the United States, of Jews seems to be struggling to establish some distance with the state of Israel. I'm thinking of Jewish Voice for Peace, If Not Now, and then the actions, for example, occupying the Trump Tower in New York, Grand Central Station in New York, demonstrations in D.C. There seems to be some ferment there. What's causing that?
The younger generation is farther removed from the horrors of the Holocaust, number one. Number two, they've probably interacted more with Muslims and Arabs, because there's a lot of Muslims and Arabs in this country now. And also, they are a majority. I mean, Jews under the age of 40 in this country, a majority, oppose what Israel is doing. How long that can continue or how effective that can be under Trump, I don't know, because they're starting to arrest people. I predict that there's going to be a lot more violence in this country. I actually think that Trump would like to see more violence in this country against people that he opposes, against people who don't vote for him. Okay, and I can see that it's possible that as these demonstrations, if they continue, that there will be more violence. You know, just like there was violence on UCLA's campus, which, by the way, a lot of Hasidic Jews started the violence. A lot of most of the demonstrators against the genocide on the UCLA campus were peaceful. And then a bunch of Hasidic Jews and police came in and they started the violence there, just as there was a lot of violence started by non-demonstrators at Columbia.
So. I'm going to interject a poem here that I think speaks to this moment that we're in. It's from Pastor Martin Niemöller. He was part of the anti-Nazi German resistance. He was imprisoned from 1937 to 1945. First they came for the communists, and I did not speak out because I was not a communist. Then they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. And then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews. I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out for me. A poem for this moment. You're listening to Richard Fohr on Israel, the U.S., and Palestine. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website, alternativeradio.org. And another poem that I'd like to read is from the Palestinian national poet, Mahmoud Darwish. It's called "The Earth is Closing In on Us." The earth is closing in on us, pushing us through the last passage. Where should we go after the last frontiers? Where should the birds fly after the last sky? Mahmoud Darwish was a great poet who died a few years ago, and this is one of his most important poems. Let's talk a little bit about Hamas. In 2006, there was an election, which you write in your book, resulted in a resounding upset for Hamas. They won 74 out of 132 seats. You noted international monitors certified the election as free and transparent, while voters viewed Hamas as relatively incorrupt. But they viewed Fatah, that is PLO, as Israel's subcontractor in occupied territory. So talk about Hamas and how it's, in a way, a product of the conflict, the occupation.
Yes.
It may surprise some to learn that Israel supported Hamas in its early days.
Well, Israel helped create Hamas. During the First Intifada in 1987, Israel collaborated with the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt to create Hamas because they wanted a religious alternative to Fatah. Israel was threatened by the nonviolent civil disobedience of the First Intifada. In the first year of the First Intifada, the Palestinians demonstrated. They passed out leaflets. It was a nonviolent movement. Israel, however, locked up or deported all the leaders of nonviolence. And during that first year, Israel killed over 200 Palestinians. They imprisoned thousands. Yitzhak Rabin, who was the chief of staff at the time, ordered his soldiers to break the bones of Palestinian demonstrators. Well, according to B'Tselem, during the first year of the First Intifada, six Israelis were killed. According to Al-Haq, Law on the Service of Man, no Israelis were killed. Nonetheless, it was a nonviolent movement in the first year. So when Israel helped create Hamas, not only did they arm Hamas, give them weapons, but they allowed Sheikh Yassin, who is the spiritual leader of Hamas, to hand out anti-Semitic hate literature calling for the overthrow of Israel. They allowed that because they didn't want to be, they wanted to make sure the world didn't see them as brutally putting down a nonviolent movement. So they wanted to incite violence and demonize Hamas. And by the way, most of the leaders of Hamas were also jailed during the First Intifada. So that was the time when Hamas came out with its infamous charter that they wanted to obliterate Israel. Now, of course, Israel has always wanted to obliterate the Palestinian people. Noam Chomsky talked about this, how that clause in the Hamas charter, which I hear repeated all the time, oh, well, the Hamas wants to exterminate all the Jewish people. According to Noam Chomsky and others, that clause was inserted into the Hamas charter while most of the Hamas leaders were in prison by a very reactionary Hamas member who is now dead and who was not accepted really by Hamas as a mainstream member. But Hamas is a resistant movement. Yes, Hamas has done horrible things, just as the IRA, the ANC, the National Liberation Front of Algeria, the Tamil Tigers, they've all been resistance movements that have terrorized populations, unfortunately, I think it's unfortunate, in order to advance their cause. The Irgun and Stern Gang in Haganah were some of the most vicious terrorist gangs. But the one thing that was different between those three Jewish organizations and the aforementioned Hamas and the other aforementioned resistance movements is that those resistance movements, Hamas and the IRA, etc., they were the indigenous people trying to expel invaders. The Irgun Haganah and Stern Gang were the invaders trying to expel the indigenous people. So their claim is not, in my opinion, does not have as much historical momentum behind it. I want to mention the leader of the revisionist movement out of which the Irgun sprung was Vladimir Jabotinsky. And Jabotinsky, who died in the 1930s and was succeeded by Menachem Begin, Jabotinsky was a huge fan of Benito Mussolini. And he would send his Irgun recruits to Italy to train with the black shirts. David Ben-Gurion, so Jabotinsky was the head of the revisionist movement, and Ben-Gurion was the head of the socialist or labor movement. And they were, at the time, they were the two most prominent leaders of the Jewish community in Palestine. David Ben-Gurion used to refer to Vladimir Jabotinsky as Adolf Jabotinsky. And I have to say that if you read a lot of the correspondence or the discussions in the late 1940s, early 50s between amongst the Israeli leaders, they're often calling each other Nazis, and they're saying things like, "Well, we cannot talk about what some of our soldiers are doing because we'd have to mention the names of those we cannot mention," you know, stuff like that. So they were very well aware that what they were doing was very similar to what the Nazis had done to them. But then over time, all of this becomes more embedded. The rationalizations become more spread out, such as, you know, the Palestinians are Nazis that want to kill us all, and then you get more and more radical leaders until you have someone like Benjamin Netanyahu. His whole life has been dedicated to the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. For years, he has been screaming that Iran is on the verge of getting a nuclear weapon for 30 years, and he has been constantly referring for years to the Palestinians as Amalekites. That is code for God told Moses, Joshua, Saul to kill every last Amalekite, including their livestock. So the religious Jews know what he's talking about. At least the religious Jews know what he's talking about. And the religious Jews are the main part of his coalition.
And Netanyahu's father was a close associate of Jabotinsky.
He was one of Jabotinsky's secretaries. And Netanyahu's father has said that my son agrees to the kinds of proposals and conditions that he knows the Palestinian, the Arab world could not possibly accept, such as we have one of Netanyahu's conditions would be the Jews must take control over all of Jerusalem. Well, the Arab world would never accept that, you know, and there's other things. But Netanyahu definitely has never, ever, the thought has never crossed his mind of making peace with the Palestinians. One time in 2009, obviously to pacify Barack Obama, he gave a speech at Bar Ilan University in which he said, mentioned that, you know, there would be peace with the Palestinians. But he didn't mean it, and everybody knew he didn't mean it, but except the stupid American suckers who believe everything Israel tells them.
You mentioned B'Tselem, that's the Israeli human rights organization. Right. The Israeli push to displace the Palestinians is not a new story, obviously. In 1937, the aforementioned David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister, said, I'm quoting, "We must expel the Arabs and take their places, and if we have to use force, then we have force at our disposal," unquote.
In 1907, Ben-Gurion talked about starving the Palestinians so they'd have to leave. And Ben-Gurion talked about terrorizing the Galilee and ethnically cleansing and killing all the people in the Galilee. And Ben-Gurion was a moderate.
You said 1947?
In 48, I think it was, when he was talking about the Galilee. In 1907, he was talking about starving the Palestinians. Levi Eshkol, who was the third Israeli prime minister, another Labor Party prime minister, Labor Party being more to the left than what we have now, and Eshkol was the prime minister during the 1967 Six-Day War. Levi Eshkol talked about starving Palestinians and forcing them to leave. Ethnic cleansing, or as David Ben-Gurion would call it, compulsory transfer, was always compulsory. It's just that they knew they had to take their time. They had to take their time because, number one, they had to make sure they maintained the support of the United States, the greatest power in the world. And number two, they had to do it gradually because they didn't want to shock their gullible Jewish supporters in the United States into thinking that maybe I'm supporting the wrong side here. Maybe these people have gone crazy and have become what they have meditated on. They've meditated on Nazi atrocities and persecutors all throughout their history, and now they're becoming what they've meditated on.
Bipartisan support in Congress, though no longer rock solid 100%, still lauds and praises Netanyahu, who, by the way, is the target, as you mentioned, of an arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court. In June, in his address to Congress, he received more than 50 standing ovations. The U.S. seems to be central in this triangle between Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. It's U.S. policy that's enabling what's going on in terms of the occupation and the huge expansion of settlements, colonies. I mean, talk about those things, but also about the kind of psychic numbing. I mean, I don't have to tell you, it is really difficult to watch the images on Al Jazeera.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Of the kids, you know, being maimed and the mothers crying and screaming. It's just unbearable. And so a kind of psychic numbing takes place. And I know people who say they don't watch the news.
Right.
They can't take it. It's too much pain.
Yeah.
What do you say to them?
I understand it. This has been going on and on and on, and I do think that part of the strategy is, Israel's strategy is that over time, people will start to forget, and then things will become more normal. But I do want to mention that without Israel even admitted it, without U.S. military support from the Biden administration, Israel would not have been able to maintain their slaughter of Gaza for more than a few months. So the Biden administration is complicit in genocide. The Biden administration could have said, look, this is a horrible thing. We will help what happened on October 7th. We will help you hunt down the specific perpetrators, but it's time to make peace. But why didn't Biden say, well, he's afraid of the Israel lobby, but had he said it's time to make peace, we're not going to give you any arms. We're going to help you make peace, and we're going to support you. And they could have made peace according to the guidelines of the Arab Peace Initiative, which gives Israel a veto over any Palestinian right of return and is flexible. It's an extraordinarily fair peace proposal, but Israel doesn't want peace.
When Israeli officials are asked why there are so many dead and wounded in Gaza and increasingly in the West Bank, they say it's Hamas's fault. They're using Palestinians as human shields. Respond to that trope, because it's widespread in all the media. It's almost an automatic, you know, they're using human shields.
Right, they've been saying that for years, and it has been refuted for years. In Israel, they have a term called the mosquito protocol. The mosquito protocol is when you detain a Palestinian And normally, if you detain a Palestinian, you're going to throw him in jail, right? But the mosquito protocol is you detain a Palestinian and use him or her as a human shield. Now, I want to read you a couple of statements from a few of these human rights organizations about the use of human shields. From B'Tselem, since the beginning of the occupation in 1967, Israeli security forces have repeatedly used Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza as human shields, ordering them to perform tasks that risk their lives. Civilians could not refuse the demands placed on them by armed soldiers. End of quote. Human Rights Watch said, the Israel Defense Forces routinely coerce civilians to perform life-endangering acts such as knock on doors, open strange packages, and search houses where the IDF suspected armed Palestinians were present. End of quote. In 2013, the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child expressed, quote, deep concern about the continuous use of Palestinian children as human shields. I've read about little kids, 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old little kids being forced by Israeli soldiers to go into the middle of the road and pick up a suspicious package. It could be a bomb. Or to knock on a door where they think there's Hamas soldiers. They've used pregnant women. And sometimes after they're done using these shields, they'll kill them. I recently read about an old man they used, and they killed him. During Operation Cast Lead in 2008-2009, Israeli soldiers would commandeer houses of Palestinians and set up sandbags as protection for themselves with no protection whatsoever for the families that were still in the houses. The Goldstone Report, which was from the United Nations Human Rights Council, Judge Goldstone was a Zionist and a highly respected South African jurist who had ruled on the genocide in Rwanda and other things, and he headed a commission that investigated what happened during Cast Lead. And he said that both sides were probably guilty of crimes against humanity, but in particular the Israeli side. And the Goldstone Report on Operation Cast Lead, quote, found no evidence that Palestinian armed groups used civilians as human shields, that they forced people to stay in areas under attack, that hospitals were used as shelters for Palestinian combatants, or that ambulances transported armed men. And I want to mention something. Before I ever studied this subject at all, this is prior to 2006, when people would say to me, well, Israel has killed children. Israel kills children. I would say, no, they don't. The only reason the children are killed by bullets that come from Israeli rifles is because the Palestinians, like Hamas and the other gangs, embed themselves in civilian population and use the civilians, including children, as human shields. I never heard that. I made that up. That just made sense, right? That was part of my internal logic. It was a collective internal logic. As I said earlier, we look at the world through the prism of how we identify ourselves.
The situation in the occupied West Bank is moving toward annexation. I think that's pretty clear. The time of Oslo in 1993, there were 200,000 settlers in the West Bank. That figure is now tripled.
Yeah,
it's at least
more than
tripled, 750,000. So, you know, gee, Mr. Forer, there you paint a really grim picture, and I'm just one guy. You know, what can I do about this situation?
You know, we can only stay attuned. We can speak to our neighbors, anyone we think might become interested, and maybe get them interested. I don't know if it does any good, but I sign petitions every day from JVP, from Defense for Children International, from U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. There's so many organizations that I'm involved with, and I try to spread the word. I don't know what else we can do. You know, Israel has so much power. I will add, in the last month, because I was once a member of AIPAC, I'm on their mailing list. So in the last month, AIPAC has been sending at least one email every day, sometimes three a day. And those emails, most of them, include, in addition to expressing Israel's point of view and how Hamas is violating the ceasefire and Israel's only defending itself, in addition, it always asks their people to write to your congressman, write to your congressman. And I read an article recently that said that Congress people receive 10 times more emails from pro-Israel group people than they use, than they get from people who support the Palestinian side. But, you know, this is a serious problem. All we can do is we have to give it our attention. I know it's very hard to look at what is going on. Sometimes I can't bear it. I can't read everything that comes to me every day. But we have to stay attuned to it. We have to give it our attention. And, you know, maybe make relationships with Palestinians. That's all I can say. Join demonstrations. Whatever you think will help get the word out, whatever you think will add to the collective conscience of this country, do what you think can help with that. And that's the best we can do. We're living in the Kali Yuga, as the Hindus would say.
Why have Palestinians been unable to achieve statehood?
Mainly because of the United States. Because the United States enables Israel to ignore international law and to reject every single peace agreement. This is not an exaggeration. They've been unable because the power of the Jewish lobby and the power of narrative. So the Jewish narrative has been prominent in the United States for more than 75 years. What is the Arab narrative? The Arabs have always been demeaned, pretty much. In my opinion, Israel controls Middle East policy in the United States.
Look into your crystal ball now and tell us what you think is up ahead.
I think things are going to get darker. As long as Trump is president, things are bound to get darker. I don't even know if he's going to comply with judicial rulings that go against him. They may just thumb their nose at all of these and see what the Supreme Court says. And even if the Supreme Court doesn't go along with Trump, he wants to be a dictator. But Trump is in the pocket of Netanyahu, it seems. Now, I'm hoping that because of Trump's ego, he'll rebel, because he can't be number two, although he's number two to Vladimir Putin also. But, I mean, right now, the Republican Party, which is dominated by Christian evangelicals, most of whom believe in the second coming of Christ, which requires that the Israelis ethnically cleanse the Palestinians, they really have incredible power right now. I don't see the Democrats getting it together to really be able to stop them, especially because most Democrats also are pretty strong supporters of Israel, even the Palestinian Chuck Schumer. So I can't really predict. I will say this. I do think that the unexamined mind, the mind that refuses to question its identity and its beliefs and images, I do think it is inherently self-destructive. And I don't see any reason why the world can't become darker and darker, you know, even though there will always be some light. But the momentum right now, judging by the election, I mean, Kamala Harris was no one to brag about, but look, we got Donald Trump. But judging by the election, what's happening in this country, what's happening in the Middle East, things are getting darker.
Well, the Canadian songwriter Leonard Cohen always says that there's always a little bit of light. Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time. I'd like to thank you very much,
thank you.
Rich. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you, and have a very good evening. You were just listening to Richard Forer on Israel, the U.S., and Palestine. I talked with him at the Boulder Public Library in late March. Richard Forer is the author of Wake Up, Essays on the Tragedy of Israel-Palestine, winner of the New York Big Book Award. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Maria Lopez Nunez, Gabor Mate, Shama Sawant, Tariq Ali, and Norman Finkelstein. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Richard Forer on Israel, the U.S., and Palestine, and for his book, Wake Up, Essays on the Tragedy of Israel-Palestine, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. or online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to the staff of the Boulder Public Library. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with oud virtuoso Marcel Khalife performing Passport.
وكان جرحي عندهم معرضا لسابح يعشق جمع الصور لم يعرفوني لا تتركي كفي بلا شمس لأن الشجرة يعرفني
Thank you. Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon. Welcome to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. Today's episode will be a continuation of the conversation that Riona Duncan and I had with Professors Christopher Mark Jones, an emeritus professor of French and Francophone Studies from Carnegie Mellon University, and Marcy Persine, an assistant professor of classics at the University of Pittsburgh, that has been one of Riona's professors. Here comes part two of our discussion of translation and various other language issues. Isn't there a sense between some different languages that one language is looked down on by the speakers of the other language?
I think that's historically true. And of course, it tends to be hemisphere-based, you know, if you look at colonial history and so forth.
This is WRCT Pittsburgh on 88.3 FM. I'm Lexi D with my show 777. I have been thinking about how